So what's the name of this podcast?
Eugene
Cast.
How am I supposed to pronounce that?
Oig Cast.
A huge cast.
Huge cast.
You're listening to
Huge Cast.
That's right. You're listening to Huge Cast, a volunteer-powered cooperative where we talk with people who may or may not live in the Eugene, Oregon area. We think they have some really cool stories to tell. So buckle up, Buttercup. It starts now. This is JoJo, and today I'm talking with William, or as I know him, Cedar Caridio. He even gave me a primer on how to like say his name, and I totally screwed it up. Cedar Caridio.
Good for you.
Caridio. That's all I got. And so Cedar is not only my awesome neighbor in the hood, but he's also an accomplished artist and sculptor, and he works in the big mediums of wood and stone, and he inlays stuff in them. And okay, I'm totally not biased, but your work is absolutely stunning.
Thank you.
And
I appreciate it.
Now it's probably out of my ability to afford it, so thank you.
We'll figure something out.
So today we're gonna just talk art, talk your art, because it's not something that I do, but I'm fascinated by it. Yeah. So just tell me how you got an interest in it or starting in something like sculpture.
It seemed like, working with hands. I taught school for many years, grade school, fifth and sixth grade, middle school-ish. And it seems like I really like to work with my hands as opposed to always, doing other stuff, talking and doing that sort of thing. So creating with the hands. So I've been doing stuff off and on in my life earlier on and never thought about it much. But then in the 80s, I started using wood a bit and just gravitated to it because in the Northwest it's so available. And importantly, I didn't have to pay for it because I could go to people's wood piles. And as long as I traded wood, they were most people were just fine with me taking a few pieces of wood. And then I was able to really start enjoying it. And then one of my brothers lived up in the Seattle area, and he connected me with a wood sculptor in the area, Dudley Carter. And he was out of Seattle, and he was, at the time, he was at the end of his life, and he was a contemporary of Diego Rivera.
Oh, wow.
Knew Diego Rivera, would go down to Mexico and hang with him.
Wow.
And also went to a 39 World's Fair in San Francisco, and he was a featured artist there, sculptor, and Diego Rivera was there. Diego Rivera painted a mural of him. And Dudley was carving monumental pieces, 20, 30 feet tall.
Wow.
And so at that fair, he carved several pieces, and they ended up in San Francisco. I think one or two, they've moved around a bit, but they were at San Francisco City College, and another one was in the Golden Gate Park, and around the Bay Area some, And they've shifted. And in Oregon here, he had some pieces at a shopping mall up in Portland, Clackamas Center. That was where it was. But they were moved. It's funny how they have their own stories. They were moved now. I saw them recently, about a month and a half ago. And they are now at a museum on the gorge, on the Washington side of the gorge. I'm trying to remember the name of the museum, and I don't remember.
Oh, like the Mary Hill Museum.
Although it's not the Mary Hill. It's another museum. It's right across the...
Like the Bridge of the Gods right over there.
Right there, exactly.
Okay. Is Mary Hill... I can't remember, but I know exactly where it is, and it's quite big.
They're large pieces.
Yeah.
They're huge pieces.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, monstrous.
That's so cool.
So anyway, running into him, and then I was mentoring with him for a bit of time. Since I was teaching and raising a family, I'd go up and spend a week or two if I could, come back home, go back and see him, come back home. And that went on for a few years. And then he passed away at like 101.
Wow.
I was like, oh no, because,
what am I going to do now?
Yeah, that was it. The teacher's gone. So from there, I just worked on my own pretty much, in between, in all the cracks between holding down a full-time teaching job and raising a family, two daughters. And so I did get time in between, you know, this and that, and really enjoyed it and felt like I really needed to do it as part of my life. It was a piece that was, I really looked forward to doing it. It was exciting. Passion came out. And so as I retired, so that was, the whole thing started in the 80s. And so I retired in 2010 from teaching, and I stepped right into sculpting pretty much full time.
Did you sell pieces before you retired?
I did. Yeah, I had some commissions, and I would sell outright. And also, like a lot of artists, we have a collection.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And personal pieces as well. So yes, that was going on. And luckily, I started. So school ended, and my other life took over. For a couple of years, I was in my own studio, which was half of a garage. And it was great because we were in the hood and I could see JoJo and several friends in the hood, which is wonderful. And I didn't have to go anywhere. But it just, the opportunity arose that through another sculptor, Mark Andrew, who's been doing it his entire life, and Mark and I crossed paths a few times. And this time we crossed and he said, "Hey, I'm doing some stone carving and have been for a while." And then I thought, okay, it's time that I start trying some stone.
Really?
And he invited me over to his studio. And so I started sculpting stone at his studio in Fox Hollow, at Fox Hollow. And then we had an opportunity after a few months of that. He said, "Well, it looks like there's a warehouse opening up in Eugene, and they're looking for people to rent the space." And so we went there, we checked it out and thought, okay, this is old world, old school. This is great, high ceilings, lots of space. Walls look like they're gonna fall down, but they looked
perfect.
And it was an old warehouse, of course, lumber warehouse.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
And so we threw in our chips there, and Randy Ortiz, young man who was trained through the university in art, and he is mainly works in metal, although Randy's so gifted, he, whatever you put in front of him, he's amazing with what he can do with that. So it was Randy, Mark, and myself, and some people in and out of the studio. And then now we have Kevin, and Kevin works in glass, so we'll see. Hopefully he's going to be part of it. So the cool thing is that we've done some pieces collaboratively, and, you know, the whole brainstorming process continues, and just the it just raises the bar, you know. You're with these great artists and inspirational, and it's wonderful to get their feedback and encouragement and support as you're working through one piece after another, you know, constantly asking, "Well, give me your take. What do you think about this one? Would you go this direction? What would you do?" Not that we always take the advice, but at least you get some feedback, and what, you know, it helps you along the way.
Well, sure. If you hit a stumbling block, like you have an entire group of people that are possibly maybe have hit that stumbling block before.
Yes.
Like, I did that once, and this is what I did to fix it, or whatever.
Yes. And Mark, he brings like 40 years to the table.
Jeez.
You know? Yeah, he's survived on being primarily an artist.
So you guys are a bunch of punks then.
Yeah, okay. I'll take it. But so that, and Mark works in stone, wood, and he does bronzes. And it's interesting because we all have different styles, which is really cool. We alluded to that before, how you want to express something, but of course not copy, because that's not, I mean, as practice that's fine, but as an artist, that's something that, it's your signature,
it's your voice,
it's your thank you. Yes. And so it's interesting how that evolves and how you want to give your take on a subject.
Yeah.
And watching Mark, how he does works on that and his style, and then Randy as well, his take on things. And I think I can look at pieces now and know that they were done by either of those artists by their style.
What is your style?
It's influenced by place a lot. And I think DNA.
Please expand.
Yeah. Well, I'm, you know, of European background, one or two generations in, on both sides, and we're back in Europe. My mom's side is from the UK, Scotland, Ireland, and with some of that Scandinavian influence. I just did my DNA a while back, so I knew some of this before. But and on my dad's side, it's like he was 100% Italian, so. And his father came from Italy, Northern Italy, and his mom was Sicilian. So there's a Italian, Northern Italian, Sicilian combo there. I've looked at some of the work, of course, from those parts of the world, and had that influence. And then, as well as being here in the U.S., the work of First Nations people, Indigenous people, carvers of the Northwest Coast here, with their remarkable work in wood and stone and metals and,
and
glass.
Everything.
Yeah. And Bill Reed, one of the foremost Haida carvers. I've seen his pieces. My mom was Canadian, so I would go to British Columbia and visit, and still do, and see the pieces of such beautiful work. And Dudley, going back to Dudley Carter, he had a certain style, and he grew up, he was Scots, and he grew up in the northern tip of Vancouver Island at the turn of the century.
Wow.
I mean, you could imagine how wild. His dad ran a lumber camp. So he talked about stories of seeing bodies in trees, because the native people out there would bury their dead up in totems and in the trees, and as a kid they'd be fall out, skeletons and stuff. So his style was so heavily influenced by native people, although his design elements were there, but it wasn't, he didn't take their exact elements,
right?
But he was heavily influenced. So his work influences me because I kind of carry that lineage. So somebody that probably didn't study Native art very much would think that maybe they were quote-unquote totem pole styles work, some of it. But
and this is your work, not
this is
not
my
Dudley's
work. No, and Dudley though has it even closer that way. But my work has that aspect to it, kind of stylized to a certain extent, not completely realistic.
Right.
I have done realistic. I don't really like to do realistic. I like to have my take of it.
Yeah.
I think it makes it more spirit-like as opposed to just copying it.
Well, you have the totem pole that was tall like a totem pole,
yes,
but it was a Celtic dragon.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there
that's
you go.
Kind of like the best of all worlds.
Right, and I actually stay away from the word totem pole because it's misconstrued so much.
Yeah.
It's more, it's a pole sculpture.
A monolith.
There's that. And, somebody, Rick Bartow, okay, he passed away about a year and a half ago. Incredible artist, lived in Newport. I went to Rick's place twice when he had a studio and when he was alive. He's Native American. His tribal people, from what I understand, came from Northern California and were forced onto Siletz from that region, or Southern Oregon, somewhere in that region. And so he grew up around Newport. Anyway, he described it that even though he was First Nations, he didn't do totem poles, and he made that very clear, because that's not his culture, that's not his tribal people. His tribal people were down here, a little bit south, not the Northwest. So he would be really clear about, I'm doing pole carving, three-dimensional pole carving, as opposed to totem pole,
right?
Because totem pole is, you start getting generational characters that are passed down from generation to generation, right. Family totems that you can only be born into the family to carve.
Right.
I mean, it's
so
like,
you don't want cultural appropriation.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Completely. No.
Nice.
No, it's extremely important to me not to do that because there's way it's disrespectful.
Yeah.
And you're not caring. A culture for you know nothing about the culture. Even if you
right.
study it, you'd have to be trained and be right there with the folks.
Yeah.
So anyway, so my style has that flavor to it, but it's not. One guy looked at my work once and goes, "Man, you know, you're a Haida Celt."
Yeah.
With the Haida folks
yeah.
and a Celt. So, and so I do. I pull on that DNA too. So I think place. Has a lot to do. We're not in Europe anymore. I'm
right.
not. And
we are a multicultural mixed bag.
We're a mixed bag.
So
yeah, we're totally a mixed bag. That's kind of where that goes. So anyway, went to Mark, back to the changing over to stone.
Wow.
So I started working with stone then, and probably that was in about 2014, somewhere in there, maybe. Yeah, 2000. We'll say 2013, somewhere in that neighborhood. And so the stone, it's really exciting because you can use some of the same tools you cross over, although they change a little to a certain degree. You have to get a little bit more intense ones with yeah. the stone. Not always.
You plug them in this time.
Yeah, there are. You can use some. Pneumatic air hammers with some of the harder stone like marble and
that's not cheating.
That no, it's still considered a hand tool.
Okay.
And I at my age
whatever grandpa yeah
my arm only lasts so long. I leave it for the finish work actually, and I don't have any apprentices, so I have to do all the work myself.
I know.
So apprentices out there, hear this.
Right. If you're interested in working in stone or learning how to be a sculptor.
Yes. Well. Yes. Because there's always that. So yeah, working with stone and learning the different types of stone. And
what's your favorite?
Well, you know, I'll start with wood. I think my favorite wood is cedar There's basically three types I work with. There's white cedar or Port Orford cedar, only found in Oregon. It's kind of the South Coast Bandon area. It's great. Beautiful whitish wood and really strong. And then there's Western Red, which most people know about. And it's found in Oregon all the way up the Northwest. Really beautiful wood. It's wonderful. And it has that reddish, kind of brownish red.
And it smells good.
It smells, all of them are
yeah.
great.
Mm.
Yeah, if you like aromatic. And then there's the Alaskan yellow cedar, which is, it's in Oregon, but only in the high elevations, kind of sparse. As you get farther north and more rain, it kind of, it starts growing more intensely, and it starts getting more toward the coast. And by the time you get in British Columbia, I was just up on the island, Vancouver Island, a little bit ago, and the forests up there are just massively densely populated with the Alaskan yellow cedar. It's a beautiful wood. It's gorgeous. It's kind of the honey, light honey color.
Beautiful.
Amber.
Could you bring me back some seedlings next time, and I'll plant them in the back 40?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're great. Great, beautiful
awesome.
Trees, and very frond-like.
Oh, pretty!
Yeah, when you see them, they look really different. Yeah, you would know right away. It's like, boy, that tree is
okay.
different.
Yeah, just pilfer some for me. I'd really appreciate it.
Right, and back to the stone. Then, you know, I have a hard time figuring out which one is that I like because all the characteristics are kind of cool. If you start with a softer stone like alabaster. I just finished an alabaster piece, and it is raspberry alabaster. It was an otter. Yeah.
Where did you get your Raw Stone.
Yeah. Well, our stone man, Tom Urban, is amazing. All the Northwest area people know, especially the stone carving community, they're pretty close and they know each other. And Tom used to be the craft center, University of Oregon Craft Center main person who ran that.
Oh, wow.
And this was several years back. He's retired, of course, but now. And one of the things he would do is he would have to order stone for all the sculptors and stuff. So through doing that, he knows he had all these connections. So when he retired, he loved stone so much, he kept doing it. And his place in Pleasant Hill now, it's a boneyard. I mean, you go up there, he's got a few acres. Oh, my God. It's huge stones everywhere, you know, some that are a few tons. And just beautiful marble, limestone, basalt.
Wow. How do I get an invitation to that guy's place?
Yeah, well, we could do it. I need to see him again here pretty soon anyway.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, I am a bit of a rock hound, as you know.
Just for carving.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like, I don't think I can peg. I don't know. Do you think he'd notice if I tried to grab something? A 2,000-pound thing. Yeah. It's like, I want
that
one.
It's funny. I think he doesn't sell for like just landscape, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
they're beautiful for that.
Right.
But he really targets the community that is for carving.
That's such a cool thing that he does.
Oh, man. Oh, it's wonderful. Tom's he's really a stone addict.
Nice.
And we need those people.
So red alabaster.
Yeah. So it's a raspberry alabaster.
Crazy.
So it's some parts of it are translucent.
Yeah.
And it's an indoor stone. It doesn't weather, so you don't carve it for outside. And yeah, so if it gets thin enough in your carving, you can light kind of, you know, comes right through parts of the carving, and it's just makes it magical, you know, to have that translucency stone, you know. So
was that a commission piece, or
was.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody came to you and said, raspberry alabaster, I want an honor.
No, the way it usually works, you know, it's a journey with somebody that you're working with. Usually it's like, you know, you start, what are you interested in? And start from there, and a few drawings. And then it came about a sea otter, because this person really loves sea otters. And so I said, okay, a few drawings and a clay model, a maquette. In clay, and then it's like, okay, now I know what you want. We have to find the stone that's going to fit this.
Oh, fun.
You know, oh, yeah. It's like going to a candy store, man. It's like, what you got, Tom?
How big of a piece did you start with for the otter?
I went up to Tom's and looked at the alabaster. Of course, he has beautiful. He had some white, like Italian white, which is really translucent. I mean, they used to use them for windows back in the day. Way. And there's part of Italy that's renowned for its alabaster, like the Carrara marble marble. And yeah, they used to use it in windows. And I believe the University of Oregon Snitzer has windows that are alabaster if you're walking up the stairs.
Really?
So anyway, after finding all that, it's like I went there and then I saw this stone and I go, the shape, you know, after I kind of knew the shape. I knew what I could get out of it, I think. That was from working all those years in just raw wood. You know, I never really rarely did I have cut cubes and stuff like that. People would give me raw wood. And because of seeing stuff in the raw wood, it helps to transfer that into stone. So if I have stone that's kind of naturally shaped, then for me it was just a transfer. And I saw one that the otter, which I thought this stone, this is it.
How big did it turn out to be?
Yeah, well, the stone started, it was 158 pounds. And it was approximately, we'll go approximations here, 2 feet long and maybe about 8 inches wide. And
so that's not too big.
Wide, yeah, but 2 feet long.
Okay.
So about like this, about like maybe 18, and maybe about like that deep, which is what, about a foot or so, something like that.
Like an old television.
Okay, but kind of squished.
An old speaker.
A speaker put sideways. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, laying down. The right. Otter's laying down.
Because that's what otters do.
But, you know, 160 pounds. I mean, did you just
hump that right to your car?
No, I don't like to deadlift stuff anymore. I used to be able to do that, but man, it takes too much on the back.
Yeah.
So I try and use wheels and lifts.
Unless I have some smart
people around, you know, that are buffed out. And
That up for me, kid.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that was the story on that. We found that one and then went on. And so that's alabaster. And then on to limestone, kind of the next. Hardness is kind of in between. You can get some softer ones and harder limestones. And they're kind of sand colored, a buff color, which in the Northwest are lovely. They're just beautiful. In the winter, they shine. You know, they're not a Carrara white marble. But they have a glow to them that's really remarkable. And they're quarried from Kansas.
Kansas?
Dorothy. Yeah, Dorothy. From Kansas.
It's a long way from the sea.
It's a long way from the sea. However, what they did see in Kansas was there were strata and they knock them off in 8-foot sections.
Oh, yeah.
Just knock. Bam. Well, they didn't have any trees.
Oh, right. So they had to use stone.
For fence posts.
Naturally. Yeah.
So, strong, heavy, would withstand. They wouldn't have to replace it every whatever.
Wow, that's pretty gorgeous, I bet.
Yeah, and it's kind of cool because the stone is, they could knock nails into it. We're talking the turn of the century, late 1800s. And they'd put them upright. Put them in the ground, knock nails into them, run their wire. So as Kansas has been, people are coming in and building, and no more the farmland's going away. Well, they have to take these down because they're in the way now. They take them down and sell them for carving.
Wow.
And so some of these crazy carvers like Tom, they go to Kansas, or he meets a guy up in eastern Washington, they bring it from Kansas over, and he gets it there and brings it to us.
Got an entire load of old fence posts. You want some?
Yeah. And the old fence posts have square nails in them.
Cool.
From like the 1800s. And I know. And
Who knew?
Some have wire. They've been worn by the wire from the wind.
Yeah.
Whipping the wire around. So you have these cool indented areas on the stone that have been the wire. They look like the monoliths in Scotland, actually. You know,
is it hard to even cut those? Like, I just see like putting one right in the yard. Can you put sandstone? Would you put that? Well, I guess it's if it's been out in a farm for forever. It doesn't matter.
Limestone. Yeah.
You just
and that's what they make a lot of buildings out of is limestone. Yeah. Portland has several, and the Midwest, Indiana.
So it's fairly reliable. So,
and I've had a few pieces outside, and they're looking pretty good.
Good.
Yeah. So, and basically with Randy in the studio, the metal man. He makes stands for us and stuff. So that's why metal and stone are natural. So he'll make a stand for our pieces, which we can attach to a foundation situation or however we want to do it. But Randy does those in a minute. Just, we had like 20 of them done.
Cool.
Metal, flat piece of metal with pipe welded to the metal to the middle of it, and then we drill in the bottom of the stone and the pipe goes right up and then we can attach the metal plate drilling and putting some
stability
stabilize it for that's really been fun. Or take the pieces, since they're very linear, a lot of people don't even know they're stone. They look kind of, people often think they're wood, which is kind of interesting.
Cool. Till they touch them.
And try and move them. 300, 400 pounds, you know. I mean,
Hey, pick that up.
Yeah. Completely. Or you can take them horizontal and carve them that way. I've done a few salmon swimming.
Cool.
In a piece, which is, that's also fun.
I just have to go back and ask one more otter question.
Yeah.
Because it was a commission, and I know that all those things takes time, but how long, once you got the stone and the design, did it take you to complete this particular piece?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm the piece is done. I'm still working on the stands to put it on. I'll go hours, because weeks are, I take breaks and have gone here and there in between.
Sure.
So I this is a real rough estimation, but I'd say approximately 120 hours.
Wow. Yeah. So you still have it in your possession.
I have it in my possession.
Yeah. I'm going to need to see a picture of that.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't taken one yet, but yeah.
Cool, yeah, because now I'm just like, what does raspberry alabaster look like in an otter?
It's really, alabaster is interesting because you can buff it up.
Yeah.
And polish it so that it's just shining.
Beautiful.
But on the flip side to that is you can...
crack it like that.
It's stronger than you think.
Really?
Yeah, because I thought that at first, but this raspberry... actually takes, it has some pretty good tolerance. However, having said that, there's always chances with stone.
Sure.
You know, there's another way to show texture on it. You can take tools and scratch into it. And what that does is, if you have it does two things. It dulls it and it lightens it. So if you take some scraping tools and you have real highly polished area that's dark, raspberry red, you go next to it and you can scratch it and scrape it, and now you've turned it into a very light powdery look that has like putting milk in with raspberry, like if you had a raspberry slurry and you threw a bunch of milk into it, that's kind of, you still see a little bit of raspberry, but you've got kind of this whitish look to it, which is
sounds
fun.
Beautiful.
You can show texture that way, and you know, putting two surfaces right next to each other. If you want to highlight the nose, which I did, you buff it out, and then the cheeks.
Right, you scrape it,
and so you've got this counter position.
Well, I'm sure that's easy for you, because that's like way above my pay grade.
Are the things that are so intriguing for me about it, is how, you know, to how you show that, how can, and different stones react differently like that. Like I couldn't do that with Kansas limestone. I can show texture, but the color doesn't change dramatically.
So do you have like a side piece of the raspberry alabaster or the limestone where you're just like, I wonder if this will work, and you go try something on a test piece so you don't screw with the main, like how do you test stuff out?
Sometimes if I'm in the roughing out stage, where I'm, you know, taking,
and this is roughing out on the stone.
Yes.
Okay.
So let's say I'm on that otter piece and I'm rough, kind of messing with it and becoming familiar with the material. That's what you're doing. And when you're roughing it out, you're taking big hunks out, and you're not really concerned too much about the final product, because you've got a ways to go to get to that last step. So in that process, I might take a little area and kind of mess around with some tools and see what it does.
Nice.
And I've seen other artists too a little bit, or that might be one of those things I might ask Mark, because he's done some alabaster, and say, Mark, you know, what do you think about this? How's this going to react? And he might say, well, this or that, or say, try it.
Right.
You know, so it's a lot of art is in my estimation, and from talking with Randy and Mark, it's, you're experimenting, and that's part of what keeps you on your edge, is that you're not quite sure, and you experiment and you try it out. They're not all, you know, you don't always end up the way you want it to go, but maybe that's wrong anyway. It's a journey, and you've got to interact with your materials, and that's where I think the magic comes in, the creativity, is that where the muses take over. You know, where you get out of the way, let it go, and let it take you on the journey to where it needs to go, and not like, I'm going to stamp it out. You know, if that's what you want to do, then go do factory work or whatever.
Right.
You know? And that's not what, for me, that's not the magic. The magic is, you are constantly shifting, and it's ever shifting situation. And I think that's part of it too. I got to say, sometimes it's a little unnerving, you know, because you aren't quite sure where you're headed. You know, it's not, there's no map,
right.
You know, and it's like, oh God, I'm not
but doesn't
sure
that
about
what
this.
That makes it kind of exciting?
Well,
and...
yeah, it's edgy. Also,
yeah.
I don't know about exciting in the point of edgy, you know,
right.
It's like,
I'm excited, but I want to throw up at the same time.
Yeah. And you know, or the things that you're in your mind when you leave the studio at night, and you're thinking, God, I don't know, man, I'm kind of cutting it close there, you know, and it's stonework, you know, especially with stone. Wood, I know it a little bit better and it's a little bit more resilient, but with stone, you know, you can be working on a piece. And if you hit it the wrong way, or you go a little bit too harsh on it, it'll let you know. And that could be like, oop, the leg's gone.
Whoops.
Or part of the head is now gone. And, you know, I understand that more, which I think when I started, I didn't think about that as much. So
yeah.
Sometimes fear is... or not fear, but not knowing is okay sometimes. Because I had this one person ask me, she was her husband was a sculptor, but he did clay and he did bronzes. So with clay, you can really dial it in because you can fix mistakes.
Right,
we'll
the head pops
that.
Off, you just put another one on.
Right. So his wife asked me, so what do you do? Because I was visiting their gallery and I said, well, I do sculpt. I do some sculpting like your husband, only I usually don't use clay a lot. I sometimes go, it's called direct carving. You go directly in. And she said, you're courageous.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to respond because I didn't think of myself as courageous. But I understood what she was saying. It took me a while to kind of digest what she said, which is, you know, that you go for the journey and things can happen.
Yeah.
And you just have to be you have to be resilient. And I've seen this in Mark and Randy both where, you know, things happen not the way you kind of were expecting it to go. And it's like you get back on the horse and you keep riding, you know, get thrown off again sort of thing and you get back on again. And that could keep going on and on, but at the end, you're on the horse, you know, and you're riding in the parade.
So do you think that's one of like the, because that sounds very life lesson-y. And I know that when one is doing a creative project,
you
can't help but a rush into the rest of your life because the lessons are always there. So what do you think a big lesson has been as you've dedicated now that you're not teaching grade school anymore, that now that you're a full-time artist, how has that translated into your everyday life?
I don't have enough time.
In a good way. That's passion right there.
Yeah, in a good way. On the other thing, you know, life clicks on, and as you get older, it becomes ever more apparent that you have a creative life span. And
what does that mean?
Well, when you die, you're not going to create.
Well, sure.
Right. The end of the sentence.
Right.
And so I think, and I see this with artists alive and those that have passed, that you're given this window of time to create, and it's really precious. And so, you know, you can't mess around. You gotta go for it. And it's not lollygag and stuff. It's like, get to work, you know? So Rick Bartow said that. He told friends that were artists, said, get to work.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
You know?
I totally get that. It's like, what are you waiting for? There's no perfect circumstance to start that painting, start that book, start that sculpture, start that art piece, start that movie.
yet completely. And the people waiting till they retire, that's a bunch of hogwash. You got, you know, get home from your job, turn that TV off, and get, you know, put some time into what you want to do, right. Because that job hopefully will end and you're going to have time. And it's great, you know, it's wonderful to pick something up after you're retired. That's cool. But what I also see is people, there's a certain amount of time you have to learn a skill for something unless you've been working on it. And a lot of times, if you're hitting the pavement running when you retire, you can go into more higher level work. If you wait till you retire, you have several years of learning the skill before you're at that level. And I find that people get frustrated because, you know, you're older and things take longer.
Sure.
And, you know, your eyesight's not as good, your dexterity. Okay, I'll stop there.
Yeah.
And so do it now, you know. The thing of waiting is silly. Because I do really believe that people are creative. I think all people are creative.
I agree with that.
And it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be, you know, like for me, it's sculpture and that. But it could be quilting. It can be singing. It can be technical art. It can be photography.
Right.
Whatever, you
right.
know. But it's what is your passion? And it could help. I find artists, not always, but artists can live a longer life because they want to get the next piece done. Let's go to the next one. I already got three in my head.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's true. I mean, you know my mother.
Yes.
And so she's in her 80s, and her passion is gardening. Is growing stuff. And it's what gets her up every single day.
And she's got a beautiful, I mean, look where she lives.
I know.
Up the,
oh, it's I mean,
gorgeous.
It's gorgeous, but it really, the older I get, I realize that those people, and I hope that I can include myself in that, like some days I'm not sure, but but it's the passion driven, like the things that get you up in the morning.
Yeah.
Is it passion or is it like, gah?
Yeah.
And you know, what is it?
It's okay to do a day job.
Oh, for sure.
You know, a lot of us have to do that. Even great artists have had to do that. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is when you're done with that, what are you going to do with your own time? You know, that,
yeah.
And how are you going to fill that need instead of anesthetizing yourself with, you know?
Don't you think there's always time? I mean, I love the stories of people that like work for the post office, but every night they come home and they work on their thing. And then
find a half hour. Find a half hour. You know, 45 minutes, whatever. But I totally do. You have to be somewhat disciplined to do that. But I think back, and because of doing that for quite, you know, 20 years or so, I was able to jump in and get up to snuff. It took me a little bit of time, and it didn't take my entire retirement to do that. Plus, I can't imagine living life not doing that.
Yeah.
Not being creative.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do that.
Yeah, it's just not who you are.
No, I just, it's got to be what is part of life for me. It's hard to say that I'm an artist. I still have a hard time saying that.
I hate to break it to you, buddy, but you're an artist.
but it's interesting saying that, though. I just want to do the work, you know? And that to me is probably the most important thing. And you know, having people look at it, getting whatever their takes on it is way cool. But getting it from out.
Yeah.
You know, from out of this into the reality of what where we are. That's, for me, that's fun.
Well, I think we're just going to end it there because that was perfect.
Yay.
So if people want to find out more about you, where can they find you? Oh, good. Glad you wrote that down.
Okay.
Where can they look at your stuff?
Oh, yeah. So, well, our group of artists that we have, the studio is 299 Garfield. And that is in Eugene, Oregon. And that's our big, huge studio set back a ways from the road. Our website is eugenesculpturegroup.com. And that will get you, and the three of us, excuse me, are on that site. And then it gives you links. And I don't really have a link there because the way I like to do it is... people can get a hold of me and I'll send photos directly through email. And then if a person's interested in stone, then I'll send stone work, small, large photos of my work and do it that way. There is a little bit on Facebook, I guess, Cedar Creadio, Facebook. I'm not even, I guess.
Big into Facebook, are you, Cedar?
No, I'm not, not too much, but there are several there. And locally I have pieces at, Eco Sleep Solutions, which sells different type of bedding and stuff. Interesting combo. But I also have people there, beautiful, Jim and Donna, and that's downtown Eugene. And there's another gallery, which is New Zone Gallery, which is on 7th across the street from the Holt Center. And there's pieces there as well. A few pieces in Sisters, kind of go over, and I'm trying to remember the name of their studio, and it's not coming to me. And I have some in Reedsport as well that I put in and out, and that one's Mind Power Gallery in Reedsport. Yeah, so that's kind of the way I do it. A good number is local numbers 541. 344-5325, and there's an answering machine if somebody wanted to get a hold of me directly. Also, my email would be cedarcoradio@gmail.com.
And cool. Well, you just gave them everything now.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's amazing.
My birthday?
No. don't do that.
No, okay.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
No personal information. Oh my God.
Yeah, but if people want to know more about your stuff, or if somebody is ready to be a an intern and help you out.
That would be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, just help you move big pieces of stone.
Well,
and
that's
wood.
Always helpful. But also to learn if somebody really wants to know.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that possibility.
You learned at the feet of a master, so.
I did.
Pass that shit along, man.
I hope so.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
coming
in today.
Oh, of course. And it's always great to see you, Jojo.
Thanks, Cedar.
You bet.
And now for some housekeeping. HugeCast would like to thank its contributors, volunteers, and sponsors. A huge thanks goes out to Mark Davis at Eugene Tech for providing guidance and enthusiasm, to Trifoya for providing equipment, space, beverages, and the occasional pizza, and to That Supergirl for providing web hosting. Our producer is Kimberly Noel. Music and soundscapes conceived by Mike Jones. Audio editors include Mike Jones and Christopher Mitchell. Audio engineer is Christopher Mitchell. HugeCast hosts are the amazing Adam Wendt and the delightful Jojo Jensen. If you like what you hear, please give us a review. 5 stars would be nice. And who knows, we might even read your comments during the show. So thanks for listening, or sleeping through it. Either way, thanks.